I appreciate you letting me know. Today is Friday, March 9th, 2015, and I called to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2219. Robin, can you give a summary of the bill, please?
Sure. Madam Speaker, members of the committee, House Bill 2219 directs Department of Human Services to convene application consolidation work group for human services programs, requires report to the Legislative Assembly by September 15, 2016, declares an emergency effective on passage, no revenue impact, may have fiscal impact statement not yet issued. There is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Nancy Nathanson. Thank you for your work on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. This is an idea that is not original with me. I imagine you may hear testimony after mine this afternoon about suggestions that this idea should be pursued. I still think it's important, and I think it's even more important now. Oregonians who need some help are jumping through hoops, and sometimes they're jumping through the same hoops over and over again in order to receive services that they need. Most low-income Oregonians in need of services are eligible for multiple types of assistance. You've heard of all of them. SNAP, WIC, Oregon Health Plan, employment-related daycare, low-income home energy assistance, weatherization assistance, job training, employment services, temporary assistance for needy families, domestic violence survivors, school-based breakfast and lunch, state children's health insurance was one, Oregon summer food service, or unemployment. That's just some of them. The list is longer. Someone may need one or more of those kinds of assistance. There are Oregonians receiving more than one type of help, and many times they have filled out separate forms to start the process for each. Within just the Department of Human Services, more than half of adults participate in more than two programs. When it comes to kids, When it comes to kids, less than a quarter of the kids receive only one program or service. Here are examples of some of the forms that we have found. One of those forms is 27 pages long. That does include pages of instructions, plenty of questions, and at the end, a testing to truthfulness. But 27 pages? And we see lots of the same kinds of questions on these forms. For example, name, address, social security number, birth date, sex, email address, phone number, race, ethnicity, information on each member of your household, monthly rent and utilities, all income sources and employment, other benefits for each member of the household, and questions such as whether anyone in the household is pregnant, is in school, and on and on. And here is an example of just a few of the applications. And we've been looking through them pretty carefully. Everything in orange is asked again on other application forms. So you just repeat things over and over, and generally speaking, your name, your birthday, your address, your sources of income are the same today as they were last week. Often they're the same as they were last month. The number of children you have, all that other stuff. There should be an easier way for Oregonians to apply for all of the services they are eligible for. This bill directs DHS, Department of Human Services, to convene a work group along with other agencies involved with housing, employment, education, and child care. It also includes the state's chief information officer. I have asked for an amendment to be drafted, and I hope you have that amendment in front of you, because I think the CIO, chief information officer, should be asked to participate, to study how to create a consolidated application process to apply for and obtain assistance. Of course, each program needs to review it, since eligibility criteria vary from one program to another. or they may need to ask an additional question or two, but asking the same set of questions over and over. Some other states have been able to achieve this simplification, like Washington and Pennsylvania. And there are a few examples of local agencies here in Oregon that have achieved some simplification, like a single application for more than one local program. Or, after an initial assessment, a provider may ask just a few extra questions, but not start from scratch. There's also the possibility of using preemptive eligibility. That means if you have already qualified for one program and the data has already been verified, then you automatically qualify for that other program. That is called preemptive eligibility. The federal government even allows for preemptive eligibility for certain programs, like energy assistance. Scarce resources can be moved then from intake and all of that review to direct services and case management, more directly benefiting those who need it. The alternative is what people go through now with all of these pages, with all this stuff highlighted in orange that's asked over and over again, repeating it every time. A consolidated application will help both Oregonians applying for assistance and the agencies and organizations who are working to help them. We should spend more time helping people and less time filling out forms. A single mother working multiple jobs to make ends meet will no longer have to spend hours filling out redundant forms for multiple agencies to receive the benefits that she and/or her children need. Other states have succeeded in this. Pennsylvania has an award-winning online application process called Compass. Compass allows individuals to submit and track their applications online all in one place. Instead of filling out multiple forms, in Pennsylvania, an individual can apply for health care coverage, medical assistance, children's health insurance, and medical assistance for workers with disabilities, SNAP, cash assistance, long-term care, home and community-based services for individuals with intellectual disabilities, low-income home energy assistance, free and reduced-price school meals, and child care, all at once, all in one place. Oregon can make a consolidated application process work as well. I hope that you'll support this effort to start the conversation anew. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Other questions?
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. So in healthcare, basically the CCOs are asking the Oregon Health Authority to pretty much do the same thing with their regulations. Then the providers are asking the CCOs to do the same thing with their regulations. So everything seems to be moving in that direction. I think these are all good ideas. Is there a way that the concept could be consolidated to have some efficiencies as they move forward with that, or is this too unique from that conversation?
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, I think the discussions are different enough that they should be separate. Some of the conversations I'm aware of with regard to CCOs and state agencies and the providers that CCOs contract with, those are about credentialing for programs and credentialing or certification for individual practitioners. This particular suggestion is about the people who are being served rather than the people who are providing the service to them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Rep. Nathanson. This slightly premature, I know, because right now you're trying to say, hey, let's go put some effort into figuring out how we would streamline this. But do you know, with Washington, because you mentioned that they've done a good job of this, has it made it so that when someone fills out an application for one of these programs, does it, in a sense, almost automatically qualify them for the others, and therefore we have fewer people tapping into more services because suddenly they have access to things they didn't know they did? Does that question make sense? Do you know how they're handling that?
Madam Chair and Representative Stark, I'm sorry I can't make that distinction for you. I'm not familiar enough with the specifics of Washington's program, mm-hmm. But there may be someone who's providing testimony after mine who has some better familiarity with it. But that's correct. There are several different things that might be achieved. One is to just consolidate the application process itself. The idea of preemptive eligibility and automatically becoming eligible could be a separate thing. The idea of advocating for or making a person asking for assistance aware of even additional programs, that's even yet another step. It may become revealed in an application process or it may not. I think each of those could be addressed separately once we determine what are the objectives. The objectives of this bill are simply a more consolidated application process, but some of those other ideas could be added or not, depending on the interest.
Representative, I was going to say that on Friday we had a talk here from the head of the Veterans Affairs and how many people get left off of claiming veteran status and being able to tap into some of the federal funds. Another discussion we're going to be having later today is looking at child care credits, the Child Independent Care Credit, which is pegged to the federal one, as well as the EITC pegged to the federal one. And I'm not sure if Chris Alanak has been able to do research since we just met this morning, but one of the things we're trying to investigate is what's the participation rate, because it seems like there are a lot of people who are not applying for those federal tax credits and thus the state tax credits, and we're leaving federal dollars on the table. And I think a streamlined process like this, we were talking about how can we get the message out to some of the low-income families that are clearly eligible for those because they're eligible for some of these other programs, and in a streamlined way to make sure that they're claiming the federal tax credits that they're eligible for. So lots of good reasons to move forward with this. Thank you for your work on it.
Thank you for hearing me.
Yep. So other people who have signed up for this are John Mullen and Janet Bird.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. A couple of things I want to say. First of all, from the Oregon Law Center's perspective, is that we work on behalf of low-income people, and the issues about getting services to people are very important to us, and there's always the interest and the safeguard that relates to confidentiality. I want to set that aside, though, for a moment and talk about this discussion from another perspective. As some of you know, I was I helped to create Clackamas County Social Services, and I was the director for 22 years. We had about 65 different funding sources and ran all kinds of different programs. The issue about simplification and application issues, these were perennial issues. I once testified in front of a congressional committee about trying to find the right nexus between then what was called aid to family with dependent children, food stamps when it was called food stamps, and Medicaid. And way back when, you know, it was apparent to me that these were things that needed to be done, and this congressional committee was supposed to come up with a way in which we could unlock these differences and make it easier. Because I think that's really what the goal is in streamlining and simplifying, is to make it easier for the consumer, the families that are seeking services, but it also has the effect of making it easier for the staff. I had a lot of eligibility people who worked for me, and I would say from time to time that I love all of you, but I wish all of this wasn't necessary, that we could simply make decisions through self-attestation or through what Representative Nathanson talked about preemptive eligibility. We used to routinely send information into the state about how to simplify and streamline and make things work on behalf of clients. And the state in those days would say, thank you very much, and they would pretty much ignore it. In recent years, though, there's been a change at the state level. When I first came to work for the Law Center, I had a discussion with then Senator Schrader and Bruce Goldberg about the work that was going to be done about simplifying and streamlining. And the state got engaged in the lean process and did a lot of work with business process mapping about how to make things simpler. When it comes to the actual application processes, there are funding sources that have historically wanted certain information for certain reasons. It's not to say that we couldn't figure out a way to get there where people would give information on a one-time basis, but we had a number of different discussions in Clackamas County about how to do this differently, including a program that we call Pathways. Another thing that we began to pilot but got worked with others, and it became something known as Oregon Helps, which gives information where people might find out how they're potentially eligible for other programs. There's, of course, the great work that we've done as a state in moving closer to having statewide seven-day coverage for 211. But all of these things are really mysterious to the people that are applying. They don't know about 65 funding sources. They just know they need assistance. Unfortunately, they wind up, because of the ways these systems don't work together, of giving their information, telling their story multiple times. So having been down this road many times, I said to Representative Nathanson that I still remain optimistic that we can make some progress. And in fact, I want to point to a couple of things in recent memory that have been really good. The fast track for food stamp and people who are on food stamps being enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, these were really good things that happened. The change at the federal level that changed Medicaid eligibility, so you no longer have to prove a categorical eligibility, like being eligible for TANF or having a disability or being eligible for long-term care, you have to first just demonstrate that you're below 138% of the poverty level. That's MAGI eligibility, modified adjusted gross income that you've heard about from time to time. So I'm excited at the idea that we could have this kind of discussion and actually make progress. Again, there's more enlightened leadership at the state level. In the old days, some of the state directors used to refer to the term crossover, which meant that if somebody was received food stamps, they might learn about medical care or child care, and this was a bad thing. Crossover was a bad thing, and I think nobody at the state level would make those kind of comments these days. We want to make sure that people get the programs that they're eligible for in a way that is that works for them and also works for the compliance that the state has to do with their various funding sources. So I, for one, would be happy to take another crack at this and support the idea and the intent behind this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm here today as the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, so I have my my Executive Director Program Manager hat on. Neighborhood Partnerships has, over its history, managed a number of partnerships helping programs work with clients. We managed a four-county, two-state initiative to serve folks experiencing homelessness called Bridges to Housing, and we currently manage the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative, which works with about 100 partners across the state to help folks accumulate assets and move forward with their goals. I've been, like Mr. Mullen, part of a lot of conversations about how we can streamline application processes. At Neighborhood Partnerships, we have an ongoing commitment to program evaluation, and so a lot of our interest in data collection and streamlining processes has been about how do we use these systems to support evaluation of impact and our reach. So I think my message today is pretty simple. You know, just from what I've seen on a small scale, it is possible to bring programs together and streamline. It's very difficult to create a system that works. And so I think a task force is a great idea. Approach it with some temerity and caution, as well as big goals. from my program management point of view, I would say that this is really important. We, as the Individual Development Account Initiative, struggle with the question of income certification and the amount of time that it takes programs to income certify people, particularly if people have been on a wait list. Do you have to certify again? Do you certify every 3 months? Do you certify every 6 months? It's an enormous effort that doesn't really move us forward in our goals. While it's important to be sure that folks are, you know, that we're meeting folks, that we're serving the folks that we intend to serve, if we know that people are being income certified elsewhere, are we able to rely on that? And so from the program management point of view, you know, are we within the boundaries of law if we rely on someone else's certification? It would be great to have some assurance, some guidelines on that. I think the other point that Representative Nathanson made is really important, that we want to remove the barriers that clients face to getting the services that they need to make a difference and to move forward in their lives. And to the extent that filling out multiple applications, providing documentation over and over and over again, to, you know, the same documentation over and over again, that's a barrier to really doing the work that we should be about as a state. And then finally, streamlined data collection will allow us to better evaluate jointly who we're reaching and whether we're having the impacts that we intend to have. So I would urge you your support of House Bill 2219. Thank you.
Questions? Representative?
I have one question on this, and it's a question of efficiencies. According to the Cato Institute in 1995, the recipients of state aid in Oregon received an equivalent of about $25,000 per year, or around $12 per hour, if you equate that, $13 per hour. In 2013, they're receiving $33,119 per year, according to the Cato Institute, or about $16 per hour, or a $6 an hour. And these prices are adjusted to inflation. So they're receiving, if you can aggregate all the services, they're receiving about $16 an hour work versus using some of these services, or maybe in this case all of the services available. Would doing this aggregating of these services, while it makes sense, would it drive that price up, or would there be efficiencies that drive that price down?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Hayden, what I would say is that if we are able to provide households with the supports that they need to actually make progress and make change, that over time we're going to see a reduction. I'm not sure that I could say what would happen in the immediate. I would say there was a study done recently by the Oregon Business Council that looked at what it means to be living in poverty in Oregon and what it really takes in terms of benefits, et cetera, to move out. And I would commend that research project to you. I can send you a copy. I thought it was a great look at, for somebody who's working, trying to move into a place of financial stability and resiliency, what does it take, and what's the layering effect of the benefits and tax credits and things like that we have available.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to share with you, and thank you for bringing this to us. My mother was a very wise woman. Even though she only went to the third grade in grade school. And so she had trouble writing. I mean, she couldn't write. I, on the other hand, had a PhD. And I had to fill out all of those Social Security, food stamps, Section 8 housing forms. I had a heck of a time. I mean, it was very difficult filling out all those forms. So, you know, and that, I'm not trying to say that all recipients don't know how to write or need help, but I think that any way we can reduce these barriers, I mean, certainly you're right, if we reduce the barriers, we're going to have more access to services, so we can anticipate then more use of the services. But the assumption being then that getting services to these folks then eventually will get them back into the workforce and to being productive citizens.
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, if I might, I think that you've hit on a really important point. I know that I went through eligibility training for Medicaid just to see what it was. And I became aware that not only was there the curriculum about it, you had to learn all the I after E's, except after C's kind of thing. There were all sorts of exceptions to rules that you had to be conversant with. And when we would hire a new eligibility specialist, we would say it took that person a year to be able to be competent to understand that work, and that's working at it every day and shadowing somebody, working with a lead worker. Incredibly complicated. So yes, people with PhDs would have trouble filling out these kinds of forms because they are very difficult to understand. And even with some electronic versions that have pop-up kind of sort of help available, can still be very difficult. And it's one of the reasons why eligibility still remains a very highly intensive personal kind of process, because somebody needs to be able to guide a person through those complex pieces of information.
Just a quick question. Are you happy with the composition of the work group? Any other suggestions on that besides adding the CIO?
Madam Chair, I looked at the list beforehand, and I think it's a good list of state agencies, and there would need to be advocates and providers around the table as stakeholders. One of the things I want to just mention that just occurred to me is that when we did some streamlining, simplifying work, it was really the workers that were doing the work themselves. One of my supervisors, in getting the whole thing started, just decided to just invite her whole staff. Mm-hmm. She brought cupcakes that she made at home, and the title of the work group that she invited people to was, "What's the stupidest thing I have to do as far as getting the work done?" Because there are so many things that are redundant and difficult. So to the extent that we can get people that are line workers that are doing some of this work, I think we'll learn an awful lot.
I just want to add just real quickly, it struck me how complicated this would be for clients, but I really appreciated what you had to say about the impact on staff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We can't forget, that's time intensive, and so we can save a few bucks if our streamlining for our staff to help. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't put that together until you presented that, and I just think it was well worth noting.
Just if I might, Madam Chair, Representative Peluso, this is the time of year when we all do our taxes.
Oh, yeah, that's
and,
a good point.
If we had 100% verification of everything we submitted, which is the way a lot of eligibility processes would work, we would all be in a really difficult time just producing all of the information, saying our name over and over again. But what we do when we put our taxes in is we attest that the information is true under the penalty of perjury. And there are random audits, and there are audits because you've tipped information in a certain way. I think we could do a number of eligibility processes like that without having 100% verification. Now, that makes people worried and nervous that some people would cheat the system and not be caught. But we spend an enormous amount of time trying to catch a few people that are going to defraud a particular program, and it creates this whole intensive process that maybe is not the best way of doing business.
Well, thanks for bringing that nightmare to head. That's great. Representative Evans?
Yep. Chair Kindergeyer and members of the committee, I'm not an expert on the task force function or its outcomes, but I would ask that as it goes forward, given the complexities of all the different programs and the ways in which people get benefits, that a couple of questions be asked, even if they're informally around the edges. And those questions are, all right, is the assumption we are trying to find ways to help people, or is the assumption we're trying to find ways to manage the resources we have? Because I think that really is the two ends of the spectrum when you talk about bureaucracies. And sometimes, to your point about the stupidest things that we do, there are things put in place because perhaps there has been too much discretion granted, and at other times there was not enough discretion granted. And at some point, as we get, I think, to a at least leaner government, if not in catchphrase, then literally fewer people doing government work, that I think we have to focus on what is the purpose of the activity. And at the end of the day, is it to say that we're doing things to people and helping them, or is it to actually help them? And if it's to actually help them, then I encourage you to ask the real big question, like, how many people do we deter, and how much time do we spend on deterring them versus how many people are we actually helping? Again, just philosophical perspective, but as you go into that work group, I think what the chair has done very well in terms of setting up the last several weeks, we've looked at all the different types of tools in the toolbox, all trying to do pretty much the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's literally a labyrinth that with a PhD or a master's or whatever confuses people. Maybe it's time to think a little bit larger picture and say, all right, if we put all these to the shelf, what would be the simplest way to help the most people that we're trying to help? So just a thought as you enter your work group. Thank you.
Chair Kenny.
It's okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know what? My question can certainly get asked. We have plenty of time. So I appreciate this bill coming forward because I do think it's not an easy process. And outside of just what folks do with DHS, then there's all sorts of other forms out there if you're doing housing or if you're doing school lunch or if you're doing all kinds of other things. And you know, I am interested in sort of that, how do you spot audit these programs? I think you're absolutely right. It would be a paperwork nightmare, having gone through a school lunch audit, to do the 3% verification of your applications. That's a lot of work. It's very labor intensive. And yet it's also very revealing. Mm-hmm. And even in a district like West Lynn, where you wouldn't think that, that there's a lot of poverty, there is. Mm-hmm. But then some of those audits actually revealed that there were some folks who probably didn't qualify and fill out the form because only 3% is going to get audited and not the other 97%. So I would like us to look at some reasonable safeguards in that. But one of the other things I actually hope comes out of this, and I know it's really specifically looking at sort of the application process, but I'm hoping there's, like in our housing work group, where we expanded that conversation by choice, that there's also an expansion of how do we think about going to the federal DHS and looking at some of the waivers that are, some waiver opportunities around just consolidation of dismantling some of the siloed pockets of money, which are causing then an application process for every. I just don't think it's enough to say it's the application process. I think it's that the fact that there are programmatic rules around every single one of these programs that we are not necessarily privy to fixing because they're rooted in federal law. They're not rooted in state law. We're just having to respond to the federal government. And if I had my druthers, I would see human services budgeting actually work a little bit more like college financial aid. You come in and you put your need forward, and not everybody needs housing, not everybody needs food stamps, not everybody needs health care. I mean, how do you then tailor and sort of front load and customize those dollars so that you can actually do what it takes to get that individual moving forward and off of the programs? So I don't think the I appreciate we want to look at applications. Our problem is rooted, I think, with federal law around these programs and what those requirements are. And if there is room out of this work group to ask the U.S. government, for the federal government, for sort of a waiver, a pilot, around taking a handful of our DHS recipients and actually looking at what would it take to break down those budgets, front load the money, figure out what people actually need. Some people need daycare, some people don't need daycare. Figure out what they actually need and see if there's a way we can propel them forward. As somebody who considers herself pretty fiscally conservative, I think that it is worth front-loading some dollars and thinking about those dollars more globally rather than siloed pools of money so that you can actually get to outcomes. Because in the current scenario, I very rarely do I see us moving people out of poverty. And we hear those stories, but the cases of multi-generational poverty stack much higher compared to people moving out of poverty. And I think it's not just the applications, it's the programs themselves. And if we want to be sort of bold and forward thinking, then I hope that we look at the actual programs themselves and see if there is room for us to ask the government, federal government, for some supports to pilot some things that are, I think, could be very innovative for Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Just a very quick comment, Madam Chair, Representative Parrish. That's a big discussion in addition to what's in this bill.
I'm sure, but, yes, but that's what I want.
You know, one of the things that the Senate Bill 450 process from the 13th session, I think it was, Senator Steiner-Hayward's bill, really identified a number of things that were really federal requirements around how to share information. And so those were set over, and I believe there's a bill or two asking for some relief from the federal government around those issues. So I'd be all in favor of saying, here's what we do around the application process, and oh, by the way, here are these other things that pertain, like the way the programs are constructed and eligibility requirements that would require some federal intervention. So I think that's a very good idea. It enlarges the scope of this discussion, but if we get to the application process and can figure out something for it and identify these other things and work on them with the federal government, I'd be interested in that as well.
Well, and the reason they're related is because the federal government has it siloed and has so many different eligibility criteria, it's what has made it challenging to do a single application. So, Representative Hayden, and then Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer, and Representative Parrish. She pretty much asked my question, but a little follow-up to that. Is there any look? It doesn't seem to include a look here with the goal of transitioning people from social services, which I've been a strong advocate for, appropriate social services that are efficient. I think it's a very important part of our society. But to tackle the generational poverty, what are we doing to partner with business, small business or large business, to help them be competitive with the, you know, $15, $16 an hour that the generational poverty families might be able to access? What it doesn't seem to be discussed very often, what we can do on the business side of it to help them be competitive, or at least include that in the conversation. Any thoughts on that?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Hayden, you know, again, I think these things all get interwoven. Again, the Oregon Business Council report that I referenced earlier is a beginning of that, you know, looking at how we think about people who are living in poverty. You know, some households have a head of households living with a disability, and so strategies for those households would be different. But I do think that the Business Council has started to look at what the role of the business community is in this work, what's the role of nonprofits, and what's the role of the public supports, and how do we look at those interrelationships. So I think there are efforts to do that, to look at how we help folks move into the workforce system, how we relate with community colleges, et cetera. This is a small part of that work, you know, looking at, again, just the beginning. How do we open the door to folks and start them down that path?
We want a grand solution.
We all do, yes.
Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. If this gets going, you might want to take a look at the work they're doing with FAFSA and simplifying it and using the IRS data retrieval tool that automatically downloads a lot of financial information into the form as a kind of initial screening process. It's some real innovative work being done there, so I encourage you to take a look at that.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Buehler, when Representative Gallegos was sharing his experiences with Social Security, I was thinking of my own experiences as a parent with the FAFSA, which, though it's been simplified, is still a nightmare. And research shows that it actually is one of the biggest barriers to, particularly to students whose parents did not go to college. Yeah. And I have a master's degree and look at numbers all day, every day. So. Mm-hmm.
They have an innovative program now where they're just looking at prior year's tax return as a kind of initial screening to really simplify it, and that's all already with IRS. It can be, you know, imported into the form very easily, so it makes it even more accessible for people.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
No one else has signed up? Anyone else want to talk about that one? Okay, so we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2219. We're going to... Yes, so this one I'm going to just skip over, right? So I'm just, we have on the schedule that we were going to have a public hearing on 2199. We're actually not ready to have that right now. So we're good. I don't need to gavel, do I?
Nope.
All right, so we're not going to open that one. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2091. This is an expansion of the Working Family Tax Credit, which we have heard before. It was actually meant to be a part of the whole lumped together hearing and possible work session, but I'm going to open it up since by protocol. We listed it separately. We're going to open it up in case anyone would like to testify on that bill alone. If you'd rather testify on the tax credits in general, you'll have an opportunity right after this. No one has signed up. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2091. And I'm going to open public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 2113, 2115, 2116, 2119, 2120, 2121, 2122, 2123, 2124. I'm going to open that, and
I think we need to summarize the bill.
Yeah, so we're not going to do a summary of each bill, but basically this is an opportunity again, and thank you for bearing with me here, on the tax credits for childcare, elderly, people with disabilities, long-term insurance. It's the whole list of them, and what I wanted to do is, you know, again, remind this committee that the challenge is now that we have automatic sunsets for every 6 years, they go to the policy committee so we can really formulate policy and then send it on to the Joint Tax Credit Committee. Both Human Services and Early Childhood Committee in the Senate, as well as the Workforce Committee in the Senate, have some kind of combination of these. And so I am trying to keep in touch with Senator Michael Dembro, who serves on both those committees, chairs one of them, to make sure that whatever we're talking about and they're talking about, hopefully we come to some kind of alignment with, so when we send it to the tax, the Joint Tax Credit Committee, it'll be easier for them. Then they just have to figure out how much money they have. So there was a work group that was called, and last Friday, the people that came around the table to focus specifically this time around on child care bills were Deanna Mack from Department of Revenue, who is here now, John Mullen, Oregon Law Center, who is here. Bill Olson, who's from HISCO, Human Services Coalition of Oregon, co-chairs with John Mullen the tax credit subcommittee of that. Bobby Weber from OSU, Child Care, Child Family Policy Group, very well known nationally on child care. Andrew Peluso from Family Forward Oregon. Matt Gerner from the Senate Workforce Committee, the administrator. David Mendel from Early Learning Division here. James Barta from Children First here. Chuck Sheketoff from Oregon Center for Public Policy. Kyle Easton, who took Chris Alanak's place since he was not available that day, from Legislative Revenue Office, and John Taponia from Eco Northwest. So I was on that, and I know Representative Bueller is an honorary member of it and couldn't come to that one, but we are going to plan a follow-up on Thursday at 1. And one of the things that I wanted to do in this session is better articulate kind of the direction that I am starting to go into, along with a lot of feedback from people, and put it in OLIS, because rather than just send something on or tweak it in a really minor way, I think it's an opportunity to take a more dramatic view of it and really think about doing something a little more significant than just sending it on. So in OLIS, there's three different things that I have put in OLIS for under meeting materials for today. The first one that says Kenny Geyer exhibit. We may take a stab at renaming these, but that's actually this piece of paper that was given to you. The next one on it, which says Alyssa Kenny Geyer testimony, is a research paper that was done by Greg Duncan and others on low-income families, and I'm going to speak to that a little when I go through this. And the next one, which says Kenny Geyer study, is a child care study of what child care costs now as of in 2014. So I wanted to just walk through this with you. I know that several of you have said it would be really helpful if you could articulate some policy ideas that we could discuss and approve or amend. And so if you can bear with me, I'm just going to kind of go through this piece of paper. Okay. So the on top, you have the working family credit, the child and dependent credit, and the earned income tax credit are the three that we're really focusing on. And I'm starting with a lot of the talk that we've already had today is just looking at the credits with in context of the other kinds of supports we give low-income families. So we have TANF that is an actual dollar amount. It's not pegged to the federal poverty line right now. Head Start is up to 100% of the federal poverty line. Oregon Health Plan, Medicaid is up to 138%, unless there's some other categories like pregnant women. WIC is up to 185%. SNAP is 150% going in, I think, but then 185% or something.
It's 185%.
Okay. And so these programs promote family stability and children's well-being, and the idea is that we want to make sure that we help families not have to be on the street, but try to stabilize them, have a roof over their head. And in the case of TANF, we're starting to redesign it so that we beef up the jobs program to really help people get back into the job market. When we were going, when the caseload grew after the recession and our state resources shrunk, we really focused on just keeping, you know, heads above water. And now that we have an opportunity to reinvest in the jobs program and give a little more substantial support, those are a lot of the efforts that are going on in some of those subsidy programs. ERDC, we've been looking at. ERDC and tax credits are kind of the main tools for families that are already in the workforce, already earn an income, to help keep them moving, you know, not only enter the workforce, they're in it, but to stay in it when they're caring for a dependent, which we know is really expensive. So I think of it as a little farther down the line. The research paper that we put into OLIS is an excellent paper on showing how families with young children experience a higher rate of poverty than families with school-aged children. High poverty has negative impacts on school performance and many other lifelong indicators. Lots of different graphs and statistics in that report. And the biggest return on investment of both financial and programmatic support occurs for younger children. So that amount of resource, both for high-quality programs as well as just direct financial subsidies, makes a much bigger impact when it's young children than it does later on. Families with children 0 to 2 have even higher child care costs due to the higher provider ratio required. So that's that third report, the Bobby Weber's report on child care costs. And there's a lot less access to infant and toddler care. For instance, the availability for people eligible for Head Start, which is the 3 and 4-year-olds, is somewhere around 65%. The availability of early Head Start, which is infant and toddler, is somewhere around 4%, maybe 5%. So harder for people to find. So some families prefer to care for young children at home, and that could be for logistical reasons, trying to get kids to child care. It could be because it's so much more expensive, especially the earlier the kids are. It might be cultural reasons. There are some groups, Native American, others, who say, you know, I want culturally appropriate care. So one of the things that, in terms of trying to help families out of poverty, is that ERDC helps child care, and the child independent credit helps people with child care, and the working family credit helps people with child care. But the EITC is really the only opportunity that we would have to help families who might want to stay home with young children. Okay, so those are some of my assumptions of why I would want to bring EITC into this mix. And out of that research paper, one of the primary strategies that Greg Duncan and others come up with is to double the amount of EITC. That's a very specific strategy. It hasn't happened in any other state. We would be the first state at looking at really beefing up EITC specifically for younger families. So on the back page, I put some of the recommendations that we discussed and honed at the meeting on Friday. First one is to streamline the tax credits. and reduce the current working family financial burden that is on the Department of Revenue, Department of Justice, and on low-income families, and to peg the state credits to the federal credits. So right now, the working family credit is a state one. It's not pegged to anything federal, and it costs the Department of Revenue about $500,000 a year, and that is in part because they have, I think, four people. Is that right, Deanna? Four people that are assigned to auditing this. With the EITC and the CDC, we can rely on IRS to do all of the audits, and we cannot with this. The other reason that the costs tend to be high is because there's no cap in the working family on expenses at all, and so that's where some of the questions come up in the audit. If somebody says they've got childcare that's $20,000, and since there's no cap on it, and it's refundable, then money is actually going back to people, and so the state feels, you know, very compelled to make sure that we're not handing out money unless it's really for an expense. And so those are the reasons that we have very high cost. The $500,000 is just the Department of Revenue cost. It's not Department of Justice or any, you know, what happens after an audit. So the recommendation that we discussed was eliminating the working family credit, taking the amount of money that's been in that and dividing it in some kind of allocation, both to the child and dependent care as well as to the EITC. If we didn't go that far, then we might want to look at least paring it down by capping expenses or limiting it to a 0-5 population where we know the child care is more expensive. But I actually, after having talked about it with a lot of people at the committee, I think it is growing support for actually eliminating it and dividing it into the other two categories. In terms of that $500,000 savings that we would have from Department of Revenue, that could be plowed back into tax credits, as well as into a marketing campaign to promote filing of the federal tax credits. One of the things that, Chris will come up after I kind of go through this and see if he can answer some of the questions that have come up. He's had a short amount of time to turn around and do some research. But one of the questions that came up from the committee on Friday was what's the participation rate on the EITC and the CDC? Because since those are federal, there's a lot of people who don't claim them, and that's actually leaving federal dollars on the table. And if we streamline our support for young families between those two federal programs and do a very aggressive marketing through DHS and the other places where people are getting eligibility, we might really increase the filing that happens and the tax credits that are coming from the federal government. So I'm going to just run through all of this and then invite Chris up and then have you ask questions that come up for you. The second is shifting the CDC from higher income families to lower income families. So we've seen graphs in the past that Chris showed us in previous the tax credit, expiring tax credits that was originally posted on February 6th. And there are two reasons that we do not support lower-income families with that particular tax credit, and the tail goes way out to upper-income families, or not upper-income, but more upper than the working family one. One is because it's not refundable, so the only way that low-income families can get any money in return and have the whole bar graph shift to the left is if it's refundable. If you have a tax, you would get a tax, your tax burden is only $1,000, but you qualify for credits against your expenses of $3,000, you don't get to claim those. So we're not actually doing our job of helping subsidize child care in that particular case. And then the other is because in the CDC is not based on adjusted gross income or even the federal poverty limit. It's on the federal taxable income, which is the below the line after deductions have been taken. And so that is the reason that this tax credit is helping families that have sometimes $100,000 in income. So shifting that to the federal poverty line, and probably tying off the tax credit at 250% of the federal poverty line. We should figure out, you know, that's what we're thinking of doing with ERDC, and that seems like a reasonable place to help families up into that level. making it refundable. The third suggestion is enable low-income working families to care for their dependent at home rather than go into institutional care when it makes more sense due to finances, logistics, or values, or will help parents offset child care costs. So they may want to keep a child at home and offset their loss of income by staying at home, or they can use EITC to offset child care costs. So the suggestion here would be to increase the EITC for families 0 to 5 and give an even higher credit for the 0 to 3, where infants and toddlers cost more. And then the CDC, you know, I think part of the ongoing discussion is, do we keep the CDC as it's currently structured, where it helps everyone equally, meaning incapacitated spouse or elder and children under 13, or do we start trying to differentiate different credit amounts and really, like, the getting farther away from a blunt instrument and fine-tuning this instrument? Do we say we want to give some to people with kids under 13, but really we want to give a little more to kids under 11, because elementary school, it's really important to have after school for elementary school. You can't leave them at home alone, and possibly more for under 6. Those are some of the fine tuning that we can do if we are making a commitment to take some of the working family credit and put it into the CDC. So those are the suggestions that I've come up with, that some have incorporated, some from the committee on Friday, and we are going to have another work group meeting on Thursday, this coming Thursday, so that's at the bottom of the sheet. I want to make sure that the public knows about it, which is why we put it in OLIS, trying to be very transparent with something that, you know, could be a fairly significant change. So Chris, could you come up, and perhaps Deanna, and be here to answer questions that may come up. So it's a work session. It's an opportunity for you all to ask questions about the thinking. Is this in the right direction? Because before we get them to say, okay, how much would it be if we put it here or here?
Just a comment. This is really helpful, and I think exactly on target. Laying it out, what you want to accomplish, and then, you know, throw it open to discussion and consolidating, you know, make it more data-driven based on the best studies of where this money needs to be concentrated. 0 to 5 makes a lot of intuitive sense, and,
right,
and I guess there's also evidence in the literature to support that. So great work.
Thank you, and I know you've been asking for it for a while. It was formulating in my mind.
It's just hard for someone new. It's complex, and, this really helps solidify things.
Yeah. And we are talking about millions and millions of dollars. I mean, I forget what the working family and the CDC is right now together for a biennium.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allen, Legislative Revenue Office. It's about $30 million between the two. The working family is around $21 million, and the CDC is $8 or $9
million. Okay. So what feedback, questions, technical questions? Do you have ideas about the shift? I mean, there are winners and losers, so we need to be clear. If we're looking at a finite number, we're thinking of taking some from more upper income and putting it toward lower. We're thinking of taking some from people who have had, you know, full access to the working family credit for kids up to 13 and moving it toward a younger age. If it's a finite number, there will be people getting more and less. Representative Evans.
Just from a philosophical perspective and then a side comment. The district I represent has some people that are very, very, very well off, although they might not consider themselves, but they relatively are, and a lot of folks in the middle. And I like the direction this is going. I like the, as Representative Bueller said, laying it out. My only concern is, I want to make sure that for those that actually have a job and are working, there isn't a perception that is, in fact, a self-fulfilling prophecy, that we incentivize folks that may not be working and having greater benefits, while folks that are working and paying taxes see their benefits go away. I want to make very sure that we don't move the goalposts while people are trying to do what they're supposed to be doing. And again, as a person who has no children and already pays money for schools that are great, but I don't attend, and or my children don't attend, and am happy to pay taxes for child care services, I just want to be very careful that as we work our way through this, that we're clear about why we're rewarding some, and that others that may be seen as losing on this are actually folks that can, in fact, still cover those costs, maybe not happily, but at least can do it, because I don't want to be moving the chairs and inadvertently create a disincentive for people to work and pay their taxes. Second thing, just as a side note, we're talking $30 million here or there. For the veterans package I talked about last week, that was a total of $10 to $15 million total. Mm-hmm. So it is intriguing that we're dealing with the numbers we are for child care, which again is a positive thing, mm-hmm. but in respect to the overarching concerns, I hope that we have just as much enthusiasm for veteran services later in the session as we are about child care. So that's my 2 cents, and I'll be quiet now.
So just to make sure that I'm clear, you're a little bit worried about doing too much of a shift from the right to the left in terms of the right being higher income.
What we perceive in this building, higher income, relative to the scale we're looking at.
Right.
Folks that are quote-unquote in the middle class but really don't still feel like they're in the middle class because of relatively stagnant real growth in many of the sectors of the economy. That's my concern. And again, from a philosophical standpoint, I am much more excited about finding ways to create either nonprofit childcare facilities or incentivizing businesses to do it on site, mm-hmm. rather than pouring a lot more into individual families one by one, because I think there is something lost when we move from the collective to the individual. But I'm willing to go along for the ride, just want to get those concerns out there open.
And I'm going to sort of echo that same thing. I appreciate the conversation. I think I don't know if our FIS folks have the ability, or revenue folks have the ability, to sort of map that out. If you have somebody who, you know, we can talk about who deserves tax money and who doesn't deserve tax money, and that's all well and good. There are people sort of in that, you know, $80,000 to $100,000 range who we're making a lot of assumptions about what they're doing with their money. And I think that that's dangerous territory for us when people have mortgages and car payments and student loans, and people who are sort of in that, maybe they've got an 8 or 9 year old, might also be starting to be at the age where they're dealing with a parent who is living with them, or there's, so we're just making a lot of assumptions about that this is disposable income for them, and it might not really be. And so I am very, before I would, you know, personally be comfortable proceeding forward with anything that moves those numbers to the lower income side of the equation, I really want to make sure that when we make that shift, or if we make that shift, that I'd like to see sort of a model, I don't know if you can do this, of if X amount of households who currently qualified fall out, what does that do to general fund resources if those people aren't having a job? I mean, you start to get into the conversation about making some shifts that could have a negative impact elsewhere in the general fund. And a lot of times when we deal with these types of, you know, issues or budgeting issues, you know, even lottery funding, you know, which we have lottery, that's great. I think we should, you know, how we budget that would be gross, you know, sales less societal cost is the real money we have to allocate. But we don't do that in this building. We just say we have all this money, and we shift some of those costs, you know, hundreds of millions of social service costs potentially over to this side of the ledger. And so I think I'd like us to be really cautious if we make that shift. What happens to somewhere else down the way in the general fund if Sally is no longer working because we have priced her out of daycare and she's buying private daycare? And like I said, I've written those checks. They are a lot to swallow. And I wouldn't put, have, you know, when we were writing those checks, wouldn't have put myself in the wealthy camp by any stretch of the imagination. And yet it was a sacrifice. And, you know, we heard a bill the other day about pay equality. And you know, and I sort of wanted to ask the question, is this going to get somebody 21 cents more, or is this going to help a mother who's been out of the workforce because she's priced out of being in the workforce, or she makes that choice? Mm-hmm. Is this going to help her get the skills she needs to be back in the workforce and be competitive? And that bill didn't do that, but I think we take a risk of and unintendedly moving somebody out of the workforce if we start to slide those numbers around. And to the extent that our very competent fiscal and revenue folks can try to help us figure that out and model that out for us, I would like to see that before we would make a decision.
So one thing I might say to that then, taking that into account, is in both those programs, you have to have an earned income. That's where it's different from some of the other SNAP and other programs. The EITC has a formula that's built into it that the more you make, the more of a credit you get back, and then it plateaus, and then it starts going down. So it's what you're saying is it's built into the formula as an incentive to work more. If we made the CDC straight out refundable, that's not necessarily built into it unless we put a minimum amount of income as the working family did. And so that might be something that we would consider, that you keep the EIDC because that's got it built in, and that you consider that nuance in the CDC as a way to ensure that you're not working 2 hours and then getting a big refundable check. So
question for Chris?
Yep.
All right, thanks, Chair. You probably had this on a graph somewhere, but I'm going back through and trying to find it. Do you remember, or could you point me to the right direction, where we may have seen the difference on the child dependent care tax credit of the amount that people could have claimed had it been refundable versus the amount that was actually taken because it's not refundable? I'm interested in seeing the difference between those two numbers. And I remember watching the formula on a single, but the actual numbers, I'm curious what that difference is.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stork, going off the top of my head, the amount claimed, it is buried in there somewhere, and without leafing through everything. So off the top of my head, I believe the amount claimed for the CDC was in the order of $12 million. Mm-hmm. And the amount that actually was used to offset liability was about $8.5 million. So it's about, and call it a $3 to $4 million difference, or in credits that go unused. But then, even having said that, they get carried forward to the next year. And in each year, about 10% of the CDC that gets claimed is a carry forward from prior years.
Chair Kengar, I just want to support what you said earlier. That type of approach would make me feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to be misunderstood here. I like the direction it's going. I like simpler number of ways to help, because we probably are catching people between two or three different things that
right.
play off each other in a bad way. But in a way to make sure that we incentivize folks in the direction, again, trying to get people out of poverty into the work world, that is an overarching philosophy.
Right.
However we can do it, I would support.
Right. That's great. One of the things that I'm hoping that we look at in this work group, in addition to the child care, is some of the other tax credits that were on our list right now to discuss as well. I just want to give a heads up to everyone that, you know, we'll take a hard look at those too, but there are four that have to do with the disabled and elderly. There's $10 million every biennium goes to children with disabilities, and there is no means test on that. We may want to look at some kind of means test. I do remember that the testimony that we had last Friday said that on average it costs $30,000 more for a family to even have a child with disability. So we might look at that, and one of the things that I'm hoping we can get was, like, you know, how far out is that income, since we don't means test it at all? Maybe we means test it, but we put the number fairly high out, recognizing there's an additional $30,000 cost. Yep.
Hey, thank you, Chair Kenegar. Just one comment on that from personal experience, when you talk about means testing and whatnot. Some of it is being able to access services that are very unusual. I have a special needs daughter, and it took us about 18 months to get that diagnosed after a very persistent father kept saying there's something going on here. And we were able to, once we got that diagnosis, we were able to quickly access the services that were set up and kind of get a pathway. And I was not allowed to pay for them, even though I offered, because I said, no, this is a covered service for this, you know, particular situation. And my wife and I did access those services until we kind of figured out, okay, what's a good route? Now, being able to afford it, we have since not continued to use those services. We've gone out to the same type of services in the private market with our commercial insurance not being a burden on it. But that was a very reassuring key point to us to be able to access that informational database for her needs and to get that type of feedback. Now, maybe there would be something where you say, okay, within 6 months, you need to transition out. But those services, regardless of your income, just are not readily available to folks when they get into a situation like that. So I would be cautioned to say, okay, just on your needs base, you can't access that information, because I think it's very important when it comes to disabled children for them to be able to access it. If you want to put some parameters around it, say, you know, you have 6 months or you have, and then a needs test comes in, it would give them a footing to try and transition into, you know, the private market or use their commercial insurance. But for us to start with, we didn't know where to start.
Yeah. Representative Evans.
Chair Kengar, and to support what's being said about kind of the beginning of it, one thing I'd request as that study goes forward, not having a lot of personal experience with this, but spending time on a school board and talking in depth with local school boards about the differential in formulaic programs and the cost of special needs folks in the school system, that as you look at the formula and perhaps maybe look at means testing, we also pay attention to the idea of aligning that special need costs to in a similar fashion to how the school districts weight it based on the type of concern. Because perhaps looking out in when you're comparing dollar to dollar, saying, well, that's a lot of money, maybe that person can pay it. But when looking at the real term costs of what is two or three or four times the cost of a child who doesn't have those type of concerns, we may be kind of cutting off our nose to spite our face in that particular argument. So perhaps in a discussion about how the formulas are put together for the schools may help us put together a formula that is at least aligned or consistent with what's going on out there. Just a thought.
Representative Bates?
Just, you know, I'm just listening to this and I'm thinking you've got quite a task ahead of you. But I was thinking not only do we need to think then about income differences and what our cap is and so on, but I was thinking about geographic differences in the state as well. I mean, what might be a reasonable income at one location certainly may not be at another location. So, like I said, yeah, fantastic.
Okay. The other one in the disability, and again, the reason I'm looking at those big chunks of money is, you know, should we even be thinking about folding those over into a child in dependent care? Maybe not. Maybe they're different enough. But the other one is for people with severe disabilities. We put about $10 million a biennium into that, no means test as well. That's probably different enough from the dependent care, because the dependent care is to help somebody stay gainfully employed while they're taking care of someone in the household that's incapacitated, a spouse or an elderly parent. This one could be an adult living on his or her own with a severe disability, and it's just adding a personal exemption, I believe, correct? There's one that's the loss of limbs. There's no means test on that. There are very few people that use it. We only give $25,000 a year. There's 500 people. They get $50.
How many people?
500 people.
And they just get $50?
They get $50. You have to lose two limbs. And those same people are covered in the severe disability, which is loss of limbs, blindness, etc. That one, if we're trying to streamline, to me, seems hard to justify, you know, and so again, I'm just putting it on the record. If anyone really wants to fight for that, then I'm tempted to not move that forward. So come, you know, let us know, come to the work group. Just know that that one is going to need some really clarification and good articulation.
It is, just a quick question.
Yeah.
Is $50 the maximum for...
Or is that the average?
It's a flat amount. It's just $50.
That's the maximum anyone
It is $50. It's the maximum. It's the minimum.
If you lose two limbs, you get $50 a year. The and then the
What's
one
rationale for that is it.
Because some legislator some years
somebody
ago,
some legislator probably had a constituent bill. That lost two legs in a car accident or
$50 seems the like the cost of administration would be nearly equal to $50.
It hasn't I'm trying to look it up. It was put in maybe in the 70s and hasn't been looked at since, and it wasn't inflation adjusted. That's part of the reason it's so small.
That's in the 70s, probably.
Well, any of them in the severe disability. So they're covered by the severe disability. There's no means test. One of the things is blindness, you know, and kind of my question is if Stevie Wonder doesn't need a tax credit for being blind. There are blind people that make really healthy, you know, I don't think we should assume that because somebody has a disability, they can't be a high earner. So, you know, anything that has to do with means testing, I think that we should look at what's inappropriate. And Representative Hayden.
Well, just on that comment, I don't know that we should assume that they claim it either, because maybe they do. I don't know. But I would suspect that there's probably a lot of these tax credits that don't get claimed by the higher wage.
Correct. And that's something you can find out, right? Because
I don't know that we could find out if somebody didn't claim it.
Uh-huh.
We might be able. It's kind of like the topic you were getting at before about participation rates, and those are inherently estimates because from one data source we can figure out how many people fit into a certain category, and then we can look at tax returns and see how many people claim a credit, and then we make some assumptions about how those two different data sources fit together, and you get a participation rate for some of the child care credits, and we could look at the number of people in the state who are blind. I'm kind of guessing that those statistics might be out there. I don't know off the top of my head.
But you could certainly have a graph that says over 100,000, over 200,000, how many people are claiming.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
but in terms of claim, yes.
Right.
In terms of claim, yes.
That if we did means test it, we can assume that we could save that much money to put into other areas.
Absolutely.
Right. And there's so the elderly one is $55. I don't know if that's an average or a straight amount. And again, not many people use it. We give out $75,000 in credits a year. That one to me is also eligible for the chopping block unless there's really a good reason to do this. So I think some of the questions with the child and dependent care is right now, if all we were looking at doing is eliminating the working family, because that all goes to child care for people with kids under 13 or children with disabilities under 18, my temptation, if we want to keep it all in child care, knowing how expensive that is to say, to the extent that we beef up the CDC, it should go toward child care. But if we were going to take from one of these other categories, from the elderly and disability, and pare that down, then we should beef up the CDC for people taking care of someone elderly, because in fact if we do that, we're helping people have an option of perhaps take care of someone at home, bring in some in care support at home while they go off to work. So those are some of the values choices again, I think, when it comes to going beyond the child care and looking at the other things on the table, and should they be folded in or should they be kept separate. So I'm just curious about reaction. Yep.
So the one that's $75,000 at $55 each is like almost 1,400 Oregonians. So do you know anything about those folks? Like, is there anything we can aggregate about sort of who they are and
the
income-wise and regionally maybe where they are? Like, I'm curious who's claiming it.
Some of that information we could get. I mean, the source is the tax return, so we can get some geographic distribution. We can get counties or cities, something like that. Income level, you know, filing status. Are they single people? Are they joint people? Some of that information we can certainly compile, and we can do that. But it's the direct information is limited to the tax return. So if you think about your tax return, basically that's where the information would come from.
And it'll be aggregated, not individual.
And is this 55 straight amount, or that's the average?
It's an average. This is one that is a function of the federal credit. And so there's a fairly complicated calculation at the federal level. And ours is a percentage of that.
And the higher their income, the more of the credit they get?
Well, there are I'm trying to think through the form now. It is, as with all things federally related, it's a complicated form, and there are different buckets of income. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it does phase out. And one of the reasons the use of this might be lower is, I believe, if you claim the Oregon retirement credit, which is not up this session, so nobody's talked about that one, that you can't claim this when taxpayers have to choose to claim the retirement credit mm-hmm. or this credit. Mm-hmm. But the 50, it's different from the loss of limbs. There is a calculation.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions on that? Long-term health insurance credits for the premiums is another one that's been on the table. There's not been a lot of support for that. Glad to see John Bartholomew from AARP in the audience. These are all things that are open for public hearing. If there's anyone that does want to vie for it, or again, there's another chance at our work group on Thursday at 1 o'clock. I'll focus the first part on child care and then open it up to some of the other ones and see if there's, you know, anything we're missing here before we just proceed and not send it forward to the tax credit committee. Yep.
One comment, Chair Kenny Geyer. One of the reasons that there may or may not be support on the long-term care is I'm not sure there is much data on it, and I would presume that the idea originally was, if these people pay for their long-term care, how much will that lessen the burden down right. the road if they have some insurance for it? That could be, because I'm sure long-term care is a significant cost to the state, and so I suppose there was trying to be a balance there, but I don't think there was ever any follow-up information on whether that worked or not. Do we know whether that worked?
I'm in the process of reaching out to the insurance division. I believe they have some information on that, and I don't know if somebody right. else has reached out to them yet or if they're listening now. But I do have a couple of names that I'm going to be contacting some folks to see if we can get the committee more information on that one.
And John has suggested calling Laura Colley, who's the head of the division, which okay. certainly I want to do too. It was started, I think, in 91, and the idea was to try to save the state having to pay for Medicare by encouraging people to purchase it. It's just that not many people have, and the ones that do are more above 100,000. So that's part of it. I mean, one way to look at it is it's hard to know because you can't compare it to anything other than rates of people who bought a very different product prior to 91. If you cut it off and you saw a dramatic drop and people like, oh, maybe that really did work, you could add it again in 2 years. That's how I look at it. It's like, if we're not sure if this is incentivizing people at all to buy it, cut it off and see what happens. Then you have some real data.
Well, and yeah.
I'm being
yeah.
really popular as chair of human services. So, telling you what I'm thinking so people can react.
Well, and this is one there are, not to stray too far, there are some overlapping policies. There is now a medical subtraction that is means tested that some people can claim as a deduction or as a subtraction the cost of long-term care insurance. And when the credit was put in place in 2000, I believe, it was just for people who established a new policy after 2000. Mm-hmm. And so there were people who had purchased the insurance prior to 2000 who were not eligible for the credit. Mm-hmm. I believe that was a cost control mechanism. It's also trying to get at the Holy Grail but for a question to mm-hmm. really incentivize new purchasers.
Real quick. Chris, you said there's a subtraction. Which subtraction?
There used to be the referred to as the elderly medical deduction that was senior medical deduction mm-hmm. that is now a subtraction,
and that can be used for long-term care
mm-hmm.
deductions.
Yes.
Okay, well that's interesting. All right, because I sat on there as we made some of those changes, and that was not ever brought up.
Are there any other things you'd like to say so far, based on the ones that we've talked about so far? Clarifications? Nothing. Then I am hoping to call up David Mandel to talk about the Office of Child Care, and maybe Chris, you can stay, or both of you can stay, because there may be questions. There are two questions on the tax credit that have to do with the Office of Child Care. One is, how do we actually raise that credit and is the state of Oregon coming out ahead or behind? So I'm hoping that that you can explain actually how that's done. And the second is, what are we spending it on, and are there other ways to fund that? Are those things that we should be spending money on, and are there other ways to fund it? Some of the pros and cons of using tax credit versus direct expenditure. So, David, could you?
I'm going to apologize that Sonia Svensson, the person who's really the expert on it, who's supposed to join me today, is out sick today. So I will not be shocked if there's questions
that I need to wait. We've not spent a lot of time on this. We did have some initial.
And I guess I should say, for the record, David Mandel, Policy Director at Early Learning Division.
So can you, maybe Chris, you can explain how we raise the money, and David can talk about how it's spent.
The credits are sold. I think it's a 75%
credit. Yes, 75%.
So a donation is made, or a contribution is made, to the Office of Child Care for, say, just for easy math, $100,000, and then the taxpayer is allowed to claim a $75,000 credit on their tax return. They don't have to be a consumer of the child care. It can be somebody, and I believe the committee heard some testimony, although I might be mixing up chambers now, that there are a lot of taxpayers who child care is just a very near and dear topic to them, so they make the contribution.
So just right there, it's like an extremely generous charitable contribution, basically. Mm-hmm. Very generous, $75,000. But it does mean, so they're let off the hook for if they have a tax liability of $100,000 and they give $100,000 to this, they now only owe Oregon $25,000. They're off the hook for $75,000. But one of the reasons that some people like it is it's like, well, Oregon netted $125,000 because it got $100,000 for expenses that it wanted paid anyway, and it still gets $25,000 to the general fund. People that don't like it say people should just give their money and let the legislature decide how general fund gets done. They shouldn't be able to designate to the cultural trust or to the child care or anything else. That's the two sides of the coin. But we do come out net ahead with this scenario.
And so my understanding is it costs the state about $500,000 a year in revenue, but generates a $600,000 and some change per year for the Office of Child Care.
Yeah, however the math works out. But yes.
Or $600,000 net. I think if their $500,000 is going to the child care tax credit, that's how much actually goes to the child care. But then there's another $100,000 that goes to the general fund. I would think that's how it would work.
There are different ways to look at it, and so it can get a little bit confusing. But tax credits can be issued up to $500,000 in tax credits. So the amount that goes to the office, I presume, is $500,000 divided by 75%. Whatever that happens to be.
Oh, okay.
So if it's 600,000, I'm sure the arithmetic is incorrect, but 600,000, one taxpayer gives $600,000 to the Office of Child Care, they get $500,000 in tax credits. That's the entire program. So that's, from that perspective, that's where the state or the program comes out ahead.
Right.
Because of that donation from that taxpayer who donated $600,000, they only got $500,000 back.
Okay.
If they still had some tax liability, that's where some money would still be going to the general fund.
Okay.
So it's kind of different sides of the same.
Right. And David, maybe you can tell us what the money is spent.
Yeah, let me give you just a little bit of a history of it. I mean, this was first developed back in 2001. And when the fund was first created, it was used originally to create a couple pilot projects to sort of look at how do you address the three pillars of child care: affordability, access, and quality. And there were a couple projects, Lane, I think Multnomah was also involved. In the last few years, basically, we took the lessons that were learned from those pilot projects and really sort of recognized that the greatest benefit for those particular dollars was really to help us with our work to support the educational professional development of the early care and education workforce, and also really to support some of our quality improvement efforts. So the funds from the revenue is now currently used for one is to support the education awards. So about 495,000 of the 895,000 that's been awarded to 3,000 plus members of the child care workforce has come from this fund. And then about $1 million is used to provide incentives and supports for child care facilities that are participating in the quality rating improvement system. So there's a couple things I would say about this at this point. At this point, this is in fact actually the only state investment that we actually really have at this point in the quality of child care in the state, an investment in the early care and education workforce. So there are other investments in those areas, but those all are coming from federal resources that we're able to access with the Child Care Development Fund and also our Race to the Top grant. But in terms of actual state dollars that are flowing to investment in quality, in supporting the quality of child care, this is basically what the state commitment to that. And then just as one side note, we also do use that as part of our state match for the Child Care Development Fund.
For maintenance of effort.
Yeah. We think for the match part, not for the maintenance of effort part. But what I would say is that we learned from those original pilot projects that providing those incentives and those support from child care can really have dramatic impact on the well-being of children. So that was really the decision. And the other part about that move was also a way of making sure that this state investment really flowed to all parts of the state and not just the parts of the state that were part of those original pilots. So that's also been part of the transition and its use over the last few years.
And you mentioned a lot more money than the $500,000. So where else are they? Are these grants?
I was talking per biennium. Uh-huh. So what I was talking about was about 1.3.
So all of the money comes from the tax.
For education award, that's about half is from this fund, and then about half is also from our child care development fund. For the incentive supports for the QRIS, that's all from this fund.
And one of the advantages to doing it this way, because I came into this going, I'm not sure this is a good way to fund these kind of why don't we just fund them? So I now get that the net contribution from the taxpayer is above what we would have gotten if this is something we would have been funding anyway. The other is that since some of it are pilot projects, rather than to have to be on a direct expenditure where you have to go back every 2 years, it's a six-year because we're doing a six-year sunset on these. So that's another. It gives those kind of pilot projects
now we're actually, none of the money is going directly to the pilot projects as pilot projects is phased out. So we are using them for those education awards. So basically, when someone who is working in child care for a minimum certain number of hours a week reaches a certain level in what we call the education registry, there's a recognition through a financial incentive for that. That's part of this. And okay. We found that's really important in encouraging the professional development of the workforce.
And there's a bill on the Senate side. Our bill is just to lift the sunset. But there's a bill on the Senate side that actually lifts the cap from 500,000 and it goes to 2 million?
Two and a half million.
So we haven't seen that on the House side. We could do whatever we want with that particular bill.
Yeah. Senator Garrett, is the 500,000 or 2.5 million, if it comes from the Senate side, is that first come, first serve, or how is that? How do you decide who gets it?
So currently, we've been able to adequately fund the education awards, so that we haven't actually had to make that choice, right? And we've also put some child care development fund dollars in there. And at this point, we haven't yet had to do that with the quality rating improvement system.
I mean on the taxpayer side that chooses
the taxpayer
to
side,
take...
My apology, I'm sorry, I was misunderstanding.
There's two sides.
My understanding that it's basically first come, first serve. Okay. So, and it does sell out every year. And the other thing we also know is there seems to be a lot of repeat customers that we get people calling every year because they really like where the resources go from that. And so there are some people now going back almost to the beginning of this tax credit who purchase it every single year.
So it's basically a self-deferred tax payment, or self-allocated tax payment. Self-allocated tax payment, not deferred.
One aspect, and the state has a handful of credits like this, one aspect of that is some control over where a given taxpayer's tax dollars go. I think that's what you're getting
at. I like it. I mean, it seems like a win-win.
Yeah.
I mean, if people are willing to pay that extra money and the state needs it anyway.
I was originally confused because I thought they were getting away with making this contribution and then only paying 75% of their tax liability. I was like, no, we should just be, you know, why are we giving rich people a break? Why aren't we just funding it normally? But once I realized that it was actually a net gain to the state, if it's something that we think the state should be funding anyway, then I think it makes sense. And then I think the question is, you know, is there, we haven't heard on this side, the need for more money and where that would go. You know, what's the compelling need for that? And we may want to open up one more session and have a public hearing on that particular one if we want to try to be aligned with what the Senate's doing. So I'll check on the Senate side. So I think maybe we've beat this one to, you know, to, yes,
Representative. Two more beating.
One more beating.
If you have a sense of what percentage of Oregonians who are eligible for the earned income tax credit don't claim it?
Percentage of Oregonians eligible for the EITC who don't claim it? I do not. I'd have to look that one up or see what I can find about that. The EITC, because I would think the participation rate is pretty high. It's a heavily marketed tax credit, and it piggybacks on a federal tax credit. And it used to be even taxpayers, when they would file their tax return, I don't know if the IRS does this anymore, and if the IRS looked at your tax return and it seemed you were eligible, they would reach out to you and contact you and say, hey, you didn't claim the EITC, would you like to? And it's also another unique aspect to it is that taxpayers can have the IRS calculate it for them. It is can be fairly complicated. But I can see what I can find out about the participation rates.
Follow-up question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think it'd be, which would be more impactful in increasing access and affordability of child care in the state, increasing EITC or the minimum wage?
That's a very good question. I don't have an answer for you off the top of my head. I'd have to mull that over a little bit.
Can you repeat that question? I'm sorry.
Let me see if I can drag it back. Which would be more impactful in improving access and affordability of child care, increasing EITC or the minimum wage?
Good question. Okay, so my intention with this is to continue working with the work group, let you know, kind of, you know, get the word out to you about what I'm thinking, and bring it back for a work session, hopefully fairly close to passing, with some real numbers, that, you know, and maybe a couple different scenarios that we might discuss, but then go ahead and pass it. So I'm going to close the public hearing and work sessions on House Bills 2113, 2115, 2116, 2119, 2120, 2121, 2122, 2123, and 2124. Thank you very much. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2585. It's a referral. It's for the purpose of referral. May I have a motion? Vice Chair Caruso. For House Bill 2585.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2585 without recommendation for passage and be referred to Speaker's desk to be referred to the House Energy and Environment Committee.
Representative Peluso moves House Bill 2585 without recommendation to the Speaker's desk to be referred to the House Energy and Environment Committee. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing none. Do I need to call the roll every time?
Rev. Bueller?
Yes.
Rev. Evans?
Excused. Who was the last next one?
Excused?
Rep. Hayden?
Yes.
Rep. Harris?
Aye.
Rep. Taylor?
Excused?
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Russo?
Yes.
Chair Kleiner?
Yes. Motion passes. Closed work session on 2585. Open work session on 3129. It's another referral. And Vice Chair Stark.
Chair Kinnegar, I move House Bill 3129 without recommendation for passage be referred to the Speaker's desk to be referred to the House Energy and Environment Committee.
Representative Stark moves House Bill 3129 without recommendation to the Speaker's desk to be referred to the House Energy and Environment Committee. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Rep. Mueller?
Yes.
Rep. Evans?
Excused.
Rep. Gallegos?
Excused.
Rep. Hayden?
Yes.
Rep. Harris?
Aye.
Rep. Taylor?
Excused.
Vice Chair Stark?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kuzma?
Aye.
Chair
Kinnegar? Aye. Motion passes. Close the work session on 3129. At our next meeting on Wednesday, we'll have an informational meeting on affordable housing, and we'll hear House Bill 2629 and 3082, and we'll also hear from the Labor Research and Education Center, LERC, at the University of Oregon. Any other announcements? We're adjourned.